the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you very much. That was my opening act on The Tonight Show, Frank Sinatra. This is John Barber, and welcome to my world. It's been an eventful 2 weeks since I talked to you last, so just a couple of quick things and the news to get caught up on. First of all, to show you how dumbed down even our new reporters are getting, there was a plane crash early this morning in the Midwest, and when the anchor asked a field reporter if there were any survivors, the reporter said, "We don't know. The investigation is still up in the air." And do you recall, a couple of weeks ago, some drunken Secret Service agents crashed into a barricade near the White House. You recall that? Well, do you also recall that last year, a young, sober mother accidentally drove near those same barricades that those drunken Secret Service agents rammed into, and she was shot. So it seems to me the Secret Service should be in double trouble. First, those two guys for being drunk, and second, the others for failing to shoot. And speaking of death, probably the death of peace and hope for it, sadly for the world and especially for the Middle East, Netanyahu this week was re-elected in Israel by a mudslide. Actor Chuck Norris came out campaigning for him. And of course, we all know Chuck Norris is to American politics what Bruce Jenner is to manhood. But proof that Netanyahu is full of crap. He won this squeaky re-election, telling Israelis he'd never let Palestine, what is left of it, after much of it was stolen or destroyed, but he said to his voters he wouldn't allow them to have their own state. Then right after the election, he told NBC, quote, "I've always been for a two-state solution, but a Palestinian state would be a terrorist state," unquote. WTF. John Bonerhead was the senator who invited this warmonger to speak to our Congress in Washington. And since the election, word is spreading around Washington and the world that Obama has intense disdain and dislike for Netanyahu. Well, we'll know that's true if he ever invites Netanyahu to take a drive through Dealey Plaza. And speaking of presidents, there is nothing in nature or in the universe that is more wasted than human sperm, especially some of it that takes. I mean, take a look at Ted Cruz. He announced yesterday he wants to be president. Well, I think some of these born-again Christians like him have to figure out a new way to be introduced into their faith other than baptism, because it seems too many like this guy are getting water on the brain. There should be a social network set up just for politicians called To Facebook. Anyway, get out the deodorizers and the toilet paper, because for the next year and a half, our media will be overwhelming us daily with coverage of the mediocrity of the candidates involved in their presidential runs. Maybe someday science will figure out a way to insert common sense and humanity into an ordinary nail. And then we can hammer it into the heads of the idiots who are running and ruining our country and the world. But you know, the really, really sad thing for me about America today is that during the Second World War, the horror of the Second World War, 100 million deaths, during that carnage under Truman, there were still scores of trials in America, trials, fines, and convictions of companies and CEOs for either trading with the enemy or war profiteering. There has not been one such trial, arrest, or conviction since John Kennedy and Vietnam, with billions illegally earned by American corporations. That is absolutely pathetic. But the encouraging thing for me about my country and America is that it produces people like my guest tonight. Now, this may be the longest introduction to a guest that you'll ever hear, but indulge me, because the profession I have the most admiration for is that of writers. There is no profession lonelier. Dorothy Parker, a successful writer herself, once said, "I hate writing, but I love having written." I'm telling you, living a life is tougher than writing. You get up every day of your life and you're facing a blank page of a day, and how you fill it, even if it's haphazard or ad-libbed, as most of ours are, determines the book that is your life. But when you're facing a blank page as a writer, you have to give it and your book some interesting meaning, otherwise you're a failure. Now, my guest has amazingly done that a dozen times. And the most amazing thing about his volumes of work is, unlike most writers who stick with one subject, he's been successful and interesting writing about subjects as different as the days, to name a few. He's co-author with Jesse Ventura of three New York Times bestsellers, including American Conspiracies and They Killed Our President, Profiles of Accomplished Black Americans called Black Genius, part one of a biography of legendary psychiatrist James Hillman, and one of the 10 best books surrounding the Kennedy assassination, The Man Who Knew Too Much. He also made a major, major contribution, thankfully, to making our documentary, The Last Word on the Assassination, the success that it is, number 15 on Amazon, as one of the three leading researchers who were in the studio with us. Now, the book he's going to talk to us about tonight is entirely different and probably the toughest book for him to write, because it's about family, a disturbed family, something we can all identify with. It's a journey through the disturbed mind of a boy, the caring heart of a father, and through a world of mystery and shamanism. It's called My Mysterious Son. Dick, welcome to the show, and I'm so glad that you're here.
John, thank you so much. Thank you so much for that introduction, and I'm really glad to be with you today, too.
I remember a year and a half ago my wife and I were sitting with you and Richard Belzer at Musso and Frank's in Hollywood, and you were talking about the book, and I was so curious to hear about what it is that you were going to write about, considering I knew nothing about you or your family or your son. So my first question is, why the book, and why did it take you so long to write it?
Well, for one thing, the book is, as you say, it's extremely personal. And I've never taken on trying to do a memoir like this. And I was concerned about my son, who is now 36, and how he would react to being exposed like this. But at the same time, I felt like, you know, I should do this because it's not just the story of a young person and a family, what they go through when mental illness suddenly strikes, in this case, schizophrenia out of the blue. That was the diagnosis anyway, when my son, Franklin, was 17. And,
If the diagnosis didn't come until he was 17, Let's get back to the beginning of the story. If the diagnosis didn't come until he was 17, there must have been something about him and his behavior that had you or you and your wife disturbed. So I have to ask you a couple of questions. Tell me how old you were when you met your wife, why your wife might be different than other wives or the same as other wives, and why your son might be different from other sons, and was your son born into what you would call, I hate to use this word, normal American household, where there is just one family in one house? Start there.
Sure. I met my first wife in the mid-1970s, and we both lived at the time as part of an extended family a group of younger people who'd come together out of the 60s folk music world originally. And
would you call that a commune?
Well, we never liked the word very much. So, you know, other people might have said commune, but we preferred to call ourselves a family or an extended family because our values were not hippie values. They were much more about, learning how to share a life together and raise our kids together. So my wife is African American, and so my son was biracial, and grew up in a world where we personally didn't see those kinds of distinctions, but of course the outside world does. And I remember when Frank was eight, I think he was eight, he was in third grade in Boston, and they at the public school system they would make you list what you were, you know, your ethnicity, and you had to choose. And I remember my son looking at me and saying, you know, with tears in his eyes and saying, you know, but I can't, I'm both. And they insisted that he check off black or white. And, you know, that's one of the things that's, of course, wrong with our society and our education system. But he grew up with that kind of, you know, facing those kinds of things. He had some sort of learning disability problems, I guess you'd call them today, when he was young. I remember when middle school wanted him to take Ritalin, and we didn't want him to do that, and he didn't. And at the same time, he was extremely bright and very talented. And, you know, there were no signs in advance, really, that suddenly he was going to have a breakdown when he was 17. And this is, I should add, classic. I think a lot of most families who have been through this experience, it happens really out of the blue. I mean, Frank,
how did it happen? In Franklin's case,
well, he had a great summer in Mexico, and at a friend's place down there in southern Baja, and all reports were he just had a wonderful time, and he'd learned to surf and fish and building projects, and he came back for his junior year of high school at a wonderful private school that had given him a scholarship in the Boston area. And I remember we were driving along one day, and he said, "Dad, I don't know what's wrong. I can't find my old self again." And, I kind of thought, well, this is just some kind of, you know, teenage angst or something. But I was wrong. I mean, he was truly suffering in a way that I had no idea, and began having suicidal thoughts, and wrote something even on the wall of his room, you know, I'm going to die and the world will be a better place. And, you know, I found it hard to believe. I mean, there were no signs anything like this was possibly going to happen. And
excuse me, I'm going to frequently interrupt you.
That's fine.
Because thoughts suddenly occur to me when you said that you're unaware of it. Were you unaware of some of what was going on with your son because you might have been an absentee father?
At that time, I wasn't. Okay. When he was younger, growing up, you know, we raised our children sort of together, and I wasn't always there when he was.
You said our children. He has siblings?
Well, he doesn't have direct siblings, but there were other children in the extended family that others had. So,
okay, now he writes on the wall that he's probably going to die and he's going to commit suicide. Did this create a friction between you and your wife? What was your wife's name, by the way?
Etta.
Did this create a friction, Dick, between you and Etta over how to handle what your son was going through?
Well, I think we both finally realized, although I was – see, we had separated by that time. We were still living as part of this extended family, but we weren't living together as man and wife. So we were often, you know, we were raising him together, you know, we're sometimes at odds over over what to do. And I, in fact, since I had not taken it that seriously, I hadn't really shared with her what was going on that Franklin had told me. So suddenly, though, one night he just he had a he went out to visit a young friend and came back and was just completely, you know, out of, how else to say it? He was out of his mind. I mean, he just he'd had a terrible break and had to be. We took him to a doctor the next day, and he was hospitalized then for a month and at that time and had to go on medication. And
what kind of medications was he put on?
Well, they call it antipsychotic, and so those are and antidepressant and another one to control what's called manic depressive behavior, ups and downs. So, you know, they weren't really exactly sure what this illness was at that time, if it was, you know, whether it was schizophrenia or bipolar, as it's called. And so, you know, with reluctance, I mean, you know, you believe in the Western medical model and you say, okay, I guess that's what he's got to do. And I should add at this point for listeners that, you know, there is a there's light at the end of this tunnel that eventually we took a whole another kind of journey together. But we'll get to that as we talk. And it was, what can I say? It was the most painful and kind of, I just couldn't believe what was happening. And you know, he was in the hospital for, as I say, for over a month. And then when the school that he was in didn't want to take him back again because they said they'd had other students go through breakdowns like this and it just never worked out. So he eventually ended up going to a different school, which was for young people, young adults or teenagers, really, with this kind of, these similar kinds of problems. And he was able to...
Knowing how meticulous you are, Dick, I'm sure that once your son was put on the medications he was put on, you probably did very extensive research into the pharmaceuticals that are used for schizophrenia and mental illness. So I'd like to have you expand a little on your knowledge about that, the use of it in this country, or the, maybe the overuse of it in this country. I'd like to know how many psychiatrist you had to send your son to, how many different schools he had to go to before you embarked on that amazing journey to Africa.
Well, it was a long story. I mean, it went on for years, and that's the whole first third of the book, which was the desperate years, as I call them. You know, I mean, Frank was in and out of hospitals, on and off medication. He hated the medication. I mean, you know, he, for one thing, it put on tremendous weight, and especially a medication called Zyprexa, which was manufactured by Eli Lilly, but was prescribed without warning label. And, you know, I mean, the fact that what I came to realize over the course of time is that although I don't disdain all pharmaceutical drugs, nor do I suggest that anybody diagnosed with a so-called mental illness should go off with their medication, but, you know, the pharmaceutical industry is really, I won't call it a racket.
The book is called My Mysterious Son. And it's an absolutely amazing, amazing journey because not only does Dick talk about what happened to his son when he was diagnosed with schizophrenia, but the amazing thing also about the son is that during his troubles and his disturbances, he kept his own diary about what he was going through. And reading a lot of the excerpts of the diary in his book, I came to the conclusion that this boy somehow bordered on genius because some of the stuff that he wrote was absolutely and totally brilliant. Now, Dick mentioned earlier in the show that his son is now 36 and that he was 17 when he had the breakdown. But Dick had always been fascinated by Africa. And he decided that he was going to take a trek to Africa because his son was, of course, half black, and to see what his African roots would be like. And so he took that trip with his son. And along the way, he ran into what you might call, what we would probably call witch doctors, but what they call shamans. And the stories that he tells about the experience that his boy had and the experience that he had with these shamans is unbelievably fascinating and sort of otherworldly, because I don't know that I believe in that stuff, but evidently it seemed to take hold and have some great meaning for Dick and for his son. So I hope we get Dick back on. Oh my goodness gracious, I wonder if there's somebody I know who has read the book who could talk about the book, because the really interesting part of the story, Doug, is when he decides, I mean, the boy has seen a half a dozen psychiatrists and he's been in a half a dozen special schools. He is interested in music and art, and he does interesting art with Chinese calligraphy. And we don't know if it's real Chinese or the Chinese that the boy made up, but I was talking earlier about the fact that the boy kept a diary, or a journal, as he called it, which was absolutely and totally fascinating. So I wanted to talk to Dick about that. But more importantly, and Dick said that we'll get to that journey, I wanted to get to the business about the experience with the shamans and the witch doctors, both in Africa, at Ojai in California, and in Jamaica, and in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So I hope we get them back. Otherwise, it's going to be really sad. The audience is going to be deprived of a really, really interesting and fascinating story. So
thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber, he put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Now the dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My son, shine so sincere, sunny one, so true. I love you.
Thank you, Doc. Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Dick, are you back?
I think I'm back. That was so bizarre.
Well, that is bizarre, because you said you mentioned Eli Lilly, the pharmaceutical company, and your computer crashed. And I was just saying to you on the phone that I'm so glad that I had read your book, first of all, because I love your work and the subject was so fascinating. But during the technical break, I had to ad-lib a little bit about some of the things in the book. So I'll just tell you quickly what I ad-libbed about is that even though Franklin was deeply schizophrenic at the time, and you and Etta were immensely concerned about him, and you're a professional writer, but your son kept his own journal. And you have a lot of excerpts from his journal in your book. And in reading these excerpts, I had the feeling that I was often reading the writings of a genius. Mm. And I don't know why that occurred to me, because your son seemed so disturbed at other times, and that's what all the psychiatrists said. And then I mentioned to the audience that aside from being interested in keeping his journal, he was also quite an artist, and he would draw interesting artwork, pastels, and they would be surrounded by calligraphy that looked oriental. And I was just wondering if these were actually words that he knew, or it was just calligraphy that looked oriental that he was making up. Do you have any idea?
You know, he'd never studied any Asian language, so he was coming up with these, sort of calligraphic depictions that, you know, I didn't know what they meant, but he would do them very fast in Asian characters and so on. And the thing that I came to appreciate so much was, he was an amazing, amazing writer. I thought, you know, a much more poetic and better writer than I. And also great.
No, you're just better organized. He is more florid than you.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
But that would probably be expressed in I mentioned to the audience that you had a fascination for Africa. And I think you had this fascination for Africa before you were married. Is that true?
Yes. I spent a year, a year and a half traveling, and a year traveling through Africa and the Middle East. When I was in my early 20s, I had resigned my dream job with Sports Illustrated magazine and taken off with a backpack and a portable typewriter in 1970 to travel the world, and ended up hitchhiking across the Sahara Desert and spending time in West and East Africa. So I had a long, strong feeling for that part of the world.
Is it possible to hitchhike through the Sahara?
Well, I don't know about today. It was pretty tough back then.
Was it camel rides?
No, it was actually vehicles making their way through the sand and through the sand tracks, I guess. I mean, it was a harrowing journey. I mean,
In that first journey, is that when you met Ernest Hemingway's son?
In Tanzania, I did, yeah. But that was when I was in East Africa.
Tell me about that experience. And the reason I want you to tell me about that is because you mentioned that when your son was 17, he talked about suicide. And, of course, we all know what happened to Ernest Hemingway himself. Tell us about your conversations with Hemingway's son and how it seems to affect the story about Franklin.
Well, it was a foreshadowing in a sense. I mean, you know, Patrick Hemingway, I stayed with him for 4 days because I was a Hemingway nut, loved his writings. And he told me the story of how his father had really suffered from a mental illness and yet wouldn't admit it, wouldn't go on medication. And finally, just ended up committing suicide when they were going to put him in a hospital. He wasn't schizophrenic, but he had definite manic depression or bipolar illness, as have had a lot of many, many well-known poets, writers, artists. I mean, it's curious.
Dick, there are a lot of people. Frank Sinatra was a manic depressive as well as a periodic. He was an alcoholic as well. Yeah. And yet some of these people function extremely well.
Well, they do, sure. I mean, there's no set thing that happens to people who have this diagnosis, and there's all kinds of manifestations of it, as much as, you know, as there are individuals. And my son had an extremely psychic component to his mental capacity, and I came to appreciate that more as the years went by, that he could he could, it was almost as if he lived in two worlds, that he could tune into my internal world, a world that was way beyond him. At the same time, he was kind of caught in himself all the time, and he could really read my thought patterns. It was pretty amazing. And that's sort of what got me on this track of thinking, you know, that first of all, don't allow him to stay on this Zyprexa medication. I hope my computer doesn't blow again, but it was well known by the pharma, by the drug company that made this drug, that it did indeed put on tremendous weight gain and result in adult onset diabetes often. And that's what happened to my son, although he has overcome that since.
Weren't there some lawsuits brought against this company that were? They lost. They had to settle.
Oh yeah, there were thousands of people got involved in suing because of the side effects of Zyprexa. And
you know, that's something that you almost never hear in the mainstream media. Because as a sidebar to the business of some of these homicidal mass murderers who take guns and go into theaters and start shooting people, is it the drug company? We find out that a lot of these people that do that are under some kind of care of a psychiatrist who's giving him medication, and lawsuits are brought against the pharmaceutical companies that dispense these medications, and they continually lose. And yet we never hear about these cases being reported on the mainstream media.
No, very rarely. I mean, the New York Times did do a big expose about Zyprexa back in, well, I read it in the, I guess it's been 10 years ago, and that's what outraged me so much, because I didn't know. I mean, it was all kept under wraps, and when I read about this, I began looking for a class action suit to involve Franklin in, because they'd been covering up for decades the health risks of this drug, and there were others that did not put on so much weight gain. I mean, Frank put on almost 100 pounds at one point. I mean, it was just tragic. And, you know, I was lucky enough to find and have some funding help from my brother to get him into a wonderful place in New Jersey for more than a year called Earth House, where they put him on an organic diet and did exercise every day in a group setting with other young people. And he was also given orthomolecular medicine, which is an alternative that's really also underreported, because the pharmaceutical companies don't want to admit it even exists. But these are nutritional supplements that help correct these imbalances or deficiencies that of somebody's individual biochemistry. And they use natural substances like vitamins and minerals and all of this to help, you know,
was he able to hold down a regular job of any sort?
No, not for a long time. I mean, he did off and on have jobs, and he did graduate from high school, and then he went to a technical school and got 32 credit hours toward a degree in mechanical engineering, and now he's gone back to school again, which is very heartening to me. He wants to do it. He's starting, you know, slow, taking one course, and very, very active today, more so than in a long time, in terms of getting out of his house and doing a lot of things. We can discuss how that came to be.
Okay, let's get to the business of the shaman, because one of the things that fascinated me and made me smile a little was when you talked about the first time it looked like you were going to dance. You were a young man, and you were in Africa, and I guess it was a witch doctor or shaman or something who was asking you to dance. And you sounded like me. It's just like being a little uptight. Tell us quickly that story, and then we'll move on to the shamans.
Well, it's a funny story. I mean, my traveling companion friend, a photographer, and I heard there was a medicine man in this West African village near Mampong in central Ghana, and we went there early one day and met with this man, and there was one young fellow in the village who spoke English, so, you know, he was giving us herbs and those kinds of things, and then they started doing this ceremony in where he was dancing and sort of going into a trance, and it was quite amazing to see, and suddenly this young fellow looked at me and said, "The drum is calling you." I said, "Me?" Because I was the most uptight dancer in the world. And anyway, I got out there and I did dance with the medicine man. And the curious thing was, I kind of felt this energy come into me. And I jokingly, I used to call it the spirit of dance. And truly, when I came back to the U.S. later, I used to take over bars with my crazy Travolta antics. Anyway, that's what happened.
Okay, now you decide to go to Africa and take Franklin. Are you taking Franklin to Africa to show him his roots and his heritage, or just to re-explore where you had gone when you were younger?
I would say it was two things. I did want to introduce him to a culture, you know, where his mother's ancestors had come from. I thought that would be interesting to him, and it was. And also, I felt like he and I, as father and son, would be able to, amid the wildlife of the Serengeti Plain and the migration, witnessing that hopefully something more would happen between us, because over time our relationship had developed. I had stopped trying to correct his quote faulty thinking or his delusions. I'd come to appreciate the poetry and in the things that he had to say, and so that's why I took him, and also because I had an opportunity. Our family pediatrician had grown up in East Africa and been raised as the son of missionary parents, and he went back there every year to see the migration. So he had an opening and said, you know, why don't you come and bring Franklin? And so I did.
Is this where you met the shaman?
No.
I believe his name was Maladoma.
Right. That is not where I met him. No. In East Africa, we simply experienced the wildlife for 2 weeks and went through a couple of very rough nights together, which I describe in the book. One when Frank just wandered off one night and disappeared, and I didn't know what had happened to him. And it had a good ending. I mean, it turned out we were at this wildlife lodge that he just wandered off into what he thought was our tent and fallen asleep in somebody else's tent. But I was pretty scared for a while. We did come through it with a really close relationship. And I then that summer, I went to a conference about alternatives or adjuncts to medication. And because Frank had gone back to school after we returned from Africa, and then he'd had another incident at school where this teacher didn't understand him and he had to quit and, you know, ended up back in a hospital for a month. And I was just, there's got to be something. There's got to be some other way, or at least some way that can be an adjunct to this merry-go-round of medication and that is so dulling in a lot of cases and deadening. And so I heard this young woman in the back of the room mention shamanism, and I was reading a book called The Horse Boy, which is a wonderful book about this father who he's a travel writer, and he takes his son along with their wife to Mongolia because all the son will relate to is horses, and the son is severely autistic. And the book was fascinating. It was about their meeting with a shaman in Mongolia, and the boy wasn't cured, but he was helped a lot by this encounter. And so I ended up reconnecting with a man named Maladoma Patrice Sommet, who is a really world-renowned shaman from West Africa. And he does workshops in African culture, but he also does what's called divinations. And so I went to Maladoma, whom I'd spoken with briefly over the phone for a different project.
Where did you meet him, and how much did it cost you to have this divination with him?
I met him in Ojai, California, about an hour and a half from Los Angeles, and it cost. It wasn't cheap. It was $250 for an hour, but I found it well worth it, because Maladoma is what you do with a divination is you move a series of objects of stones and cowrie shells and rocks and beads, and you know, you move them in a pattern, and then when he tells you to stop, you're moving them clockwise with your strong hand, and he tells you to stop, and then a pattern is formed on this cloth, which is a quadrant, and it may sound strange to a Western listener, but it was quite amazing. He could read then the pattern, and he began to talk to me about a number of things that were important. First of all, he could see this otherworldly nature of my son, and the fact that he was very similar to a shaman in some ways, and had this kind of power, you know, inherent in himself. Along, and Belladonna said, you know, he's not really sick. I mean, there's really, you've just got, he wanted to meet him. And he said, there was work I had to do in invoking my own ancestors, because they didn't really understand who my son was. He said, you know, it's like they need to give Franklin a place at the table, which was a kind of a remarkable way to put it. And I ended up, you know, here I am, a white guy in my mid-60s going out to a beach in Malibu, performing this water ritual.
That stunned me. That absolutely, because you seem to me like the very last person in the world. I mean, I hate to call it hocus pocus, but there had to be something that this shaman said to you that must have convinced you there's something to moving all of these shells and the pattern that your movements of these things create. Because I must say, I was staggered. But not only did you do it once, you did it a couple of times.
I did. And I took Franklin to meet him in Jamaica. And all I can really say is there was it was a feeling. You know, it was a feeling that that this man had tuned into something that was very important for the future well-being of my son and for the relationship I had with my son. And you know, he said, in a way, it's kind of like you're his biographer, you know, which was strange because I keep keeping notes all these years trying to understand what was going on. But, you know, and I, in fact, did end up writing this book. I was thinking about it after Africa anyway, because it was a story that I wrote it because I felt like it could be of help or beneficial to families like mine, who suddenly encounter this kind of a situation.
And you also introduced Etta, Franklin's mother, and Franklin's mother also underwent this divination the same way that you and Franklin did?
Yes, eventually she did. And because she and I were no longer, as I said, married, but we were still very good friends and communicated a lot. Been through a lot, obviously, over the years. And she ended up also meeting Melodoma and seeing him for not only a divination, but she ended up going through a ritual that went on all night, sort of a ritual about her that had to do with her own past and a healing kind of thing that was designed to help her in her life and in her relationship with our son. So, yeah, it was an incredible, totally surprising, out of character, I guess you'd say, journey for me to undertake. But
had your son not been as disturbed as he was, and had you not been as concerned as you were about his well-being and his future, do you think you would have ever had a divination on your own?
I don't think so.
I don't think so. I don't think so either.
I didn't do it for myself. I did it
I didn't do it. The overall result of this is your son a little better, the same, a lot better. Now, you said he's going back to school, which thrills you. Is he still on some kind of medication? And does coming from what you call an extended family, not a commune, but an extended family, do you think that had any effect upon him whatsoever?
Oh, well, that's a lot of questions. But I would say he's more than a little better. I think that through taking him to Jamaica to meet himself with Melodoma, and they had quite an hour together. I mean, Melodoma told me later, he said, "My God," he said, "your son had my head spinning. It was like meeting a colleague." And Franklin sat there and did drawings for him the entire time with his curious characters. But Melodoma could sense in him this connection to ancient civilizations, to cosmology. I mean, you know, stuff that I can't possibly see. But I do trust that these kinds of things exist. And I trusted this man's training and intuitive wisdom. And what out of it, first of all, I think it gave Franklin a lot of self-confidence going to Africa and then, you know, being in Jamaica and loving the country so much for a week and meeting Melodoma. And then, you know, he's just been so much more active. He's He went off to a school in Maine last summer to learn how to build wooden boats. He's gone to take art classes at the museum school and music therapy, where he never took real formal piano lessons, but he can, you know, play these jazz riffs that are quite amazing. Go ahead.
When you went to Albuquerque, you met another person like Melodoma. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that was a little different. Well, he was a Native American. He wasn't Native American. He's a Peruvian healer who had moved to Albuquerque, named Mino, and through a friend that was taking us around the area, the sacred lands around New Mexico, which Melodoma had suggested might be a good place for us to go. And Franklin had always had a real interest in Native cultures. Franklin didn't want to do a particular treatment with this fellow, so I did it myself. Frank says, why don't you do it? So I did. And that was interesting, too. I mean, you know, it was a whole ceremony that went on for about an hour, and sort of going back into discarding things from my past that had happened to me when I was young. And so it was, I don't know, it's been fascinating.
My producer, Mike Kim, who's just a brilliant young man, wants to join in the conversation. Are you there, Mike?
Yes, I am. And, Dick, I want to apologize for the sound problems earlier. And, you know, this whole conversation, it's just magnificent. And it leads me to the question, does your shaman do interviews? I mean, we need to hear from the man himself, and perhaps your son. I don't know. What do you think, John? I think this should be an extended...
I don't want to pay $250 for the hour, but I'd be happy to talk to him. And in the book, Dick, it said it was $500 for the first visit.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's true, because I did. I wanted to do two consecutive hours.
So you can see that I certainly read and enjoyed the book. Okay, I've got to say this. First of all, Shakespeare said it 400 years ago. There are things in heaven and earth that are undreamt of in your philosophy. So I don't know whether I believe the experience of you and Franklin being changed and improved by this experience. I believe that emphatically. I don't know that I believe in the rest of it. I'll tell you something interesting. My wife has demonstrated two or three times that there is something psychic going on. I mean, the truth is, and there was a famous, oh God, you probably know the guy's name. In the early 50s, he was a USC professor who had a local show in Los Angeles who used to talk about science and the universe. And he talked about the fact that we were all electrical beings. All life was electrical. So as electrical beings, we were transmitters and receivers. And that when we die, some of those last electrical impulses are off there out in the ether, and other people who are more attuned might be able to receive them. I can't remember his name. I thought it was Baxter, but I can't remember. Anyway, when my wife was expecting our son, she was 6 months pregnant. I'd seen her demonstrate psychic things, and I ignored it because I'm uptight, okay? I'm a Dick Russell, okay? Anyway, we were leaving San Francisco. I just performed at the Hungry Eye. I was leaving, coming back home. She embraced her father. We get home. She begins crying. My wife never cries. She cried for 2 weeks. And I must say, I thought my wife had lost it. And I told her, do you want me to get help? I didn't know what to do with her. And I didn't really believe in psychiatry, because I must say, in many instances, I thought insanitary was voluntary, because people just get tired of the hassle. And then finally, I begged her to tell me what was wrong. And she said to me, Dick, I'm never going to see my father alive again. Her father was 63. He looked like Anthony Quinn. He had black hair. He had all his teeth. He was so handsome and vibrant. And I said, what on earth are you talking about? She said, I touched him. And she had this thing about touch. She could tell things about people from touch. She said, I'm not going to see him alive. And I said, you're crazy. You're crazy. He had a heart attack and died the next week. They had misdiagnosed a clot in his leg and he died. She has demonstrated this numerous times. Now, so I believe that part about the book. So what I would say to you, what would you recommend because there are literally hundreds of thousands of young people in this country who are in the same position as Franklin, but probably without the caring parents that this young man has. What would you suggest to them if you were talking about alternative sources for cures like you accidentally found when you went to that conference? What would you say to them?
Well, first of all, that there's perhaps no cure. And, you may have to stay on medication, but maybe not as much. But if it's caught early, in other words, if you're not forced into a medication regimen that goes on for years and years, there are other models. There are, unfortunately, they're not very widespread, but there was one, this was something called Soteria, which they bring young people together who have this similar problems, and they really work on a group talk therapy thing, and they work it out together. And it's really important to have peers that you can talk to, because you're going through something that is so foreign to most people and agonizing. There's also orthomolecular medicine, which are vitamin supplements that can be taken, and there is the shamanic world that certainly can be beneficial. I mean, the research is there. I mean, you can there's a really good website called madinamerica.com, which gets into some of the alternatives and also the dangers of some of these medications. I mean, you've got to research what the side effects are, and none of them are completely quote pure, but some are better than others, and it's just, but it's such a mysterious, I don't know, is it a disease, is it a, I mean, there've been a lot of research done looking at how shamans and those diagnosed with schizophrenia are not that dissimilar. I think there's a recognition that needs to happen among parents too, that, but maybe their child is in tune with a greater reality than they themselves can know. I'm not talking about a Christian sense of something, but that there's a world that their child may be inhabiting or getting messages from that is not necessarily to be dismissed as crazy. I mean, there's something to it and has to be both accepted and maybe never understood. I mean, maybe a parent is never going to understand this because they don't have the so-called affliction. But, we've got to begin getting away, or let me say incorporating more than this medical model, which has seen psychiatric drug sales rise 50-fold since 1987, from $800 million to more than $40 billion a year. And all of the, more and more people going on disability payments, and now to children. And I think that's really wrong. The kids, 16,000, I think the figure was, were diagnosed with mental illness that needed, what's called psychotropic medication back in 1987. Today, it's more than 600,000. So we're talking a vast increase in the prescribing of these antipsychotic drugs to kids as young as 5. And that, I think, is just unconscionable and wrong. There's got to be a better way to do it. You're not schizophrenic when you're 5.
That's a societal insanity in itself.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
But, Dick, that's the society we live in. I mean, if you talk publicly about spiritualism, and I'm not talking about religion, I'm talking about spiritualism and the whole mystery of life and the universe and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Like I said, the most wasted thing in the universe is human sperm. But I mean, if you talk about these kind of things, they think you're cuckoo.
Yeah, I mean, that is true, and people listening today may think I'm nuts and I went off on a tangent that I should have just accepted things, but I've seen a difference. I've seen a difference, and it's.
What is the most startling thing you've discovered about yourself in this journey with your son, and then the most startling thing you've discovered about Franklin, and maybe about his mother, who seemed to say in your book that she almost felt reborn after that experience. Go ahead.
Well, I've certainly, what could I say? I would not wish this situation on anyone, but I will have to say that I have learned a great deal about life from my son about not just acceptance, but about, being open to new ways of looking at what you do about a terrible problem or terrible affliction, and how you can, learn to relate in a different way and be and open yourself and the child to greater experiences. And I think in him I've seen, well, part of it may just be, he is growing up. I mean, the medicine does say that, as you get older, often the symptoms of a psychotic break, or schizophrenia lessen. So that may be what's happened too. And at the same time, I'm just so pleased and proud that Frank has gotten out there and he's doing all kinds of things and likes to be a jack of all trades. I wish he'd stick to, being an artist or still wrote things like he did 10 years ago, but he wants to do other things. So it's a fine line between, I've certainly been through all those issues of the parental control.
I had sort of wished that after reading the book and thinking about it, I thought, how wonderful if I could get a hold of Dick and if Dick could get a hold of Franklin and Franklin would come on for the last 10 or 15 minutes and talk about where he was, where he's been, and what he's doing now. Sadly, he didn't wish to do it, but I would have loved to have talked to him. When you do talk to him, tell him that I'm really, really happy for him.
I will do that, John. And, he's a very private person. I think he doesn't have a problem with the book, in the sense that, I gave it to him to read. I don't know how much of it actually he did read, but, I sent him the book in the mail when it came out finally. I'd given him chapters earlier, and I said, so what do you think? Did you get it? And he says, yeah. And I said, what do you think? He says, oh, it's a nice book.
Robert Kennedy Jr. thinks it's more than a nice book, and I must imagine there must be literally thousands of parents in this country, if they ever run across a book, are going to send you a thank you note.
Well, that would be wonderful. I mean, I have received some. The book's certainly not a bestseller. It's word of mouth. It's slowly getting out, but I've received some beautiful letters already from people and reviews on Amazon about the book. And that's why I wrote it. I hoped, I didn't write it to expose my life or expose my son. It's just I felt like I hoped that people would gain, not only relate to it, but gain the idea that there is light at the end of many a dark tunnel with this.
Well, it certainly was an enlightening and interesting and often entertaining read for me, and I'm glad that you wrote it. Actually, I was kind of stunned at what it was because I didn't expect it to be what it was. Because a year and a half ago, you were just talking about the fact that your son was schizophrenic and he was biracial, and you were writing a book about the experiences that you had. It's much more than I ever expected, and I really thank you so, so much for being here. And I would like you to come back at some other time, because there are bunches of people who want me to talk to you about the Kennedy assassination and your work in that area. And then also, I've asked you already, and you did it, you contacted Jesse Ventura. You tell Jesse that he has got to come on this show because I want to ask him one question. And if he only comes on for that one question, and that one question is this. When he said this a couple of times in passing and never expanded on it. When he first became governor of Minnesota, he said he was visited by a half a dozen or 10 or a dozen guys who identified themselves as CIA agents. Is that true?
Yeah. He doesn't make things up.
I want to know how he knew they were from the CIA.
They told him that.
Yeah. Did they show him identification?
I wasn't there, but...
Did he take down their names because they had to make a meeting with him? That's what I want to talk to him about. Why on earth would the CIA want to be talking to a newly elected governor? It had nothing to do with national security.
No, and in fact, they're not even supposed to operate in this country. But
no, they're not. So anyway, the next time you talk to your co-author, tell him he better get on the show.
I will do that.
And if it's true, what Mike asked, would the shaman come on a show like this?
He might. Well, I'll ask him. I'm still
Please do. Again, Dick, thank you so very, very much. And the best of luck to you. You're just terrific. Thanks again.
Thank you, John, so much for having me.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye.
Well, that's it, folks. If you get a chance, it's called My Mysterious Son by Dick Russell. It's one of a dozen terrific books he's written. And I'll see you again in a couple of weeks with a fella that's going to tell you about some books that you have to read that are almost impossible to find because they're heavily censored by the government and the media. Thanks so much for being here. See you in a couple of weeks. Bye-bye.
Spark of nature's fire, you're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.